You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Across the table from me, only one of my co-panelists, but a very important one, Neil Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Neil, of course, a sports writer at 538. Kate Fagan is slowly making her way back from book leave. She will hopefully be with us soon.
Do we have a percentage, Chad, of book completion?
I have not received the update. Our statistical model has been running, though, and we are at 98% complete, according to the model. Now, that allows for some unforeseen circumstances to have taken her away from her computer, computer crash, a hard drive failure, that kind of thing.
I don't want to say I don't trust the model, but when I call it up, it looks exactly the same as the Domino's Pizza Tracker meter. So I'm just saying.
Neil, I'm unfamiliar with the Domino's
Pizza Tracker. Oh, you don't know the Pizza Tracker.
Neil, I'm very familiar with the state of your kitchen and your refrigerator, but I do not know how familiar you are with Domino's Pizza Tracker.
Well, I did Domino's one time very drunkenly in Boston, staggered into the hotel at maybe like 1:30 in the morning.
Was this the night you were talking to me about the Challenger
disaster? It might have been. Okay. Yeah, it might have been. And so leave us your comments and your reviews about that. But I drunkenly ordered a pizza on Domino's, and it was very entertaining to follow the progress as it makes it from your order being received, the toppings being put on, it goes into the oven, they tell you who is bringing it to you.
It's their a percentage progress. Complete.
Oh yeah, it's like it's a bar. I think there might actually be different skins. You might be able to pick like the standard default skin is kind of the Domino's color scheme, but you might be able to go sepia toned if you want.
And now a word from our sponsor. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Domino's.
It's hot.
The premier.
Hot and fresh.
The premier tracking service for all of your pizza delivery. all right, let's get to the show. Kate will be back soon. But on today's show, we're going to go to France, where British cyclist Chris Froome won his third Tour de France in the last 4 years over the weekend. Froome is part of Team Sky, a dominant force in cycling and one that critics accuse of being so smart it is ruining the sport. That's the kind of take that is catnip. For stuff like us, Neil just made a steroid into his bicep gesture, as I said, smart, and put smart in air quotes like he was Donald Trump. I like that. Anyway, that's the kind of take that analytics are ruining the game, that is catnip to folks like us. And so we couldn't resist asking the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay to come chat with us about Team Sky, what makes them special, and what makes them so hated. And then on to baseball, where the trade deadline is upon us, and all across the nation, fans of bubble teams are fretting about whether their team's general manager should empty the farm system this year and go for it, or wait until conditions are more ideal in years to come. Neil will help walk us through when MLB teams should buy, sell, or hold, according to the numbers. And finally, Nemkadi Ogumike is having the breakout season to end all breakout seasons in the WNBA. The LA Sparks forward has gone from good player to leading MVP candidate, shooting 100% in a game in June and putting together one of the best WNBA seasons of all time. We'll make sense of how Ogumike could get this good this fast and talk about when the WNBA got to be so top heavy. All right, on to this week's show. Team Sky has only competed at the Tour de France for 6 years, yet with Chris Froome's latest victory over the weekend, they've now won 4 yellow jerseys in that 6-year span. That's the kind of outlier that we need help making sense of. And so here to give an assist is Jason Gay of the Wall Street Journal. Jason, welcome to Hot Takedown.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Okay, so Jason, run us through. I think I'm most interested in Froome's team and Team Sky, since they have done so well in the 6-year span. So run us through, what are they doing differently than everybody else?
Well, this was a completely built from the ground up, holistic team that was built for the express purpose of, putting a UK stamp on the sport of professional cycling. Going back a couple decades now, Great Britain became very motivated in the sport of bike racing, not just on the road and the track, And Team Sky is the brainchild of a guy named Dave Brailsford, who has been sort of the, you know, ring or the man behind the ascension of British cycling over the past bunch of years. And they, of course, have British sponsors, you know, Sky Television, RAFA, which is a British clothing brand. And, you know, they basically approached it from a Formula One standpoint. You know, if people follow Formula One racing, they know that there are, you know, very, very technologically savvy, spending-dominant teams like McLaren and so on, Ferrari. And that was basically the Sky approach here. Brailsford talks a lot about what he calls, quote-unquote, marginal gains, and the idea of, you know, through small manipulations of technology, diet, training, you can make the kinds of gains which can radicalize a cyclist's success. And, you know, when you consider, of course, the other alternative, which is pharmacological marginal gains, that has, of course, been something that shadows Sky as it shadows any cyclist team with success in this generation. It's just sort of a part of the business, unfortunately.
So Sky, that's Rupert Murdoch, right? Like, this is a team that has a lot of financial backing, I take it.
Yes, I mean, so one of the title sponsors is Sky, and then also 21st Century Fox, which is also a under the Murdoch umbrella. I should mention that, you know, as an employee of the Wall Street Journal, there is a line that you can draw from the Wall Street Journal to 21st Century Fox. It used to be, in fact, they're separate corporate entities now, but we always do make that disclosure where we talk about Sky in the Journal simply because a lot of people still make that connection. But I wish I had some sort of bat phone to Team Sky because I would like a bike.
So, Jason, you wrote a piece about how financial sort of disparities are really starting to affect cycling and Team Sky being a good example of that. I think their budget was something like $38.4 million in the last year or to get the Tour de France race mounted or their team mounted for it, whereas most teams maybe have a third or even half of that. Half that or even a third of that. Are we seeing income inequality in cycling, and how's that affecting the sport?
Yeah, it's pretty drastic, and it especially shows itself in something like the Tour de France. So, you know, cycling has three big grand tours. It has the Giro d'Italia in Italy, Tour de France, and then the Vuelta, the Tour of Spain in the later part of the summer. And that's really the focus of the racing calendar. Those are the races that the big sponsors want to win. That's where all the money gets poured in. And Sky has, you know, again, this is a team that began with a mission, and that mission was to win races like the Tour de France. And so they have gone all in terms of spending on riders. I mean, that's the number one expense for cycling teams. You know, bikes are bikes and team buses are team buses, and some are more nicer than others, but, you know, by and large, the expenses are kind of flat across the sport. The real money is being spent on teams, and for people who might not follow bike racing, team dynamics are really, really important in something like the Tour de France, because what you can do with a great, great rider like Chris Froome is you can protect him from the wind. You know, there's actual aerodynamic science here where if you have your teammates riding in front of you, you expend somewhere 20% to 30% to 40% less energy. You have guys who can go off and chase down attacks from opponents that you won't necessarily have to do yourself. And then they can sort of fetch for you. They're called, quote-unquote, domestiques, which is a French word for butler, and they're the guys who go and get you your water and your snacks and all that kind of stuff. And so you basically can build a super team. And Sky, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, is your sort of Golden State Warriors-esque super team. They have a couple of riders in Geraint Thomas and Wout Poels who would be leaders on virtually any other team. And here they are, basically glorified domestiques for Chris Froome. And the reason they're on Team Sky and doing that is that Team Sky can spend that money. So the complaint within the peloton is that these races begin with just a team like Sky with an incredible advantage simply because they're able to put the dollars together to buy a super team. And when you consider how cycling is a sponsor-driven sport, you can't really sell tickets to things like the Tour de France, it's very, very volatile economically. And so it's given Sky, which has stability, economically, a real advantage over the past half decade or so.
So is it that Froome is that good, or how much do some of those advantages that you brought up play into him winning all these Tour de Frances?
He was asked this question during the race and gave a very candid answer, which I thought was extremely telling. Someone asked him, okay, Chris, you know, acknowledging all your victories, were you to be put on one of these lower budget teams, were you to be put on a team with a half or a third of the budget of Sky, would you be, in fact, in contention to win a Tour de France? And he said, no. He said, I probably wouldn't. I would be one of these guys trying to win individual stages, trying to do things like get into breakaways and so on. I would not be in contention to win the Tour de France. And I thought that was a really, first of all, humble admission on his part, because you know, the normal reaction is be like, screw you, of course I would be the contender.
So, Jason, I want to get back to the analytics side of it, and I think, as you put it, marginal gains that they pursue.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that they use a program called Training Peaks, which has, like, power meters that they're seeing the sort of output of energy from their athletes, and they have a different physiological regimen because they aren't racing necessarily on these smaller races, because those aren't testing them the way the Tour de France would test them. And I'm curious whether or not what they're doing fits with other models in other sports of the way that analytics are working, or is Team Sky up to something different?
Quite a bit different with regard to the real use of a piece of information called wattage. So that's sort of the gold standard. That's the number that matters within cycling. That is the power output produced by a cyclist. And the real thing that they look at is a figure called watts per kilogram. So it's, you know, the weight of the rider into the amount of wattage that is produced, you know, during a particular moment of the race. And they know that if they can get a rider who can ride at X watts per kilogram, or they're able to maintain a certain wattage over a certain amount of distance, that those are going to be indicators of great achievement on the road. And those are the things that they look for. You know, cyclists now, very early in their careers, are often taken to federations. They do it here in the United States, and they look at their power, and they can tell. You know, they can tell at a relatively early age in the development of a rider if they have what it takes. Guy, like every team in the peloton now, looks very much at those figures and is able to say, okay, well, we have the legs or we don't. And when you line up, again, with not just one but two or four or five guys even who are capable of producing significant power and a significantly high watts per kilogram rate in the mountains, you know you have what it takes to contend for the Tour de France.
It's interesting as you describe it. It's very much a physics problem as much as it is sort of a data analytics problem. It sounds almost
very much so,
especially scientific.
And you know, I know that for a great many people, their first thought, sadly, about professional cycling is doping, and that is something that people inside and outside of the sport are paying more and more attention to. Data to look at it and say, okay, you know, is that consistent with what we know to be clean performance, or is that, you know, an indicator of, you know, doping? And it's a tricky thing. You know, teams are reluctant sometimes to release all the data out there because they're fearful of misrepresentation, or you could, you know, say, well, maybe they're trying to hide something, but it's certainly one of those things that people are taking a much, much closer look at. And I want to add something here which is important, which is that Bo Cycling has had these crises, and deservedly so, over the past generation. They are by far the most tested class of professional athletes worldwide. Were we to subject any sort of American sports league to the kind of dope testing that they have for professional cycling, which includes things like whereabouts testing, where they can get you at any time. It includes now nighttime testing, where they can knock on your door at 3 o'clock in the morning in Tour de France. No league in America would ever stand up to that. So, you know, they're both sort of the whipping boy of doping, but also, you know, leading the way in terms of at least trying to address it.
So last question for you, Jason, and then we'll let you go. I'm curious whether or not all of this sort of hyper-focus on analytics has led to a backlash against Team Sky, not just because of the money stuff, but because they're, you know, making the sport too clinical or too much by the numbers, and we see this in all sorts of sports outside of cycling, obviously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that the quote-unquote clinical approach to winning races by teams like Sky, and we should point out, going back to the days of Lance Armstrong and the U.S. Postal Service, which employed very much the same kind of approach of taking five or six talented riders up the mountain and then slowly siphoning them off until you get to Lance. It's not a very exciting way to watch bike racing, and yet this year, Chris Froome, who was somebody who people, you know, I think considered somewhat dull of a rider, did some pretty remarkable things on the bike, including, I don't know if you guys got a chance to see it, running up the mountain, running up the Mont Ventoux in the race's second week after he lost his bike in a crash. So all of a sudden, there's poor Chris Froome stripped of his bike, click-clacking up the mountain in his bike shoes. He finally did get a bike relief, but he did some funny things in this tour, which I think added to character. People in cycling, especially French fans, like to refer to what they call panache and the idea of, you know, kind of the romantic attacking style of racing. And there was a little bit of that from Chris Froome this race. So I think his overall reputation improved significantly during this tour.
Okay, Jason, that was great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can read more of Jason's work about the Tour de France at the Wall Street Journal, and we'll put a link on our show page at 538.com. Okay, now on to baseball. Earlier this week, the Yankees traded reliever Aroldis Chapman to the Chicago Cubs for a package of four players, a huge haul, headlined by top shortstop prospect Gleyber Torres. Were the Cubs right to give up so much for such a short-term gain, albeit a very good short-term gain, 2.01 ERA, 100.1 mile-an-hour fastball on the average, etc. Here is Mike Gold Jr. trying to answer that question on ESPN.
And then you've got the Cubs, who have built it the other way for so long now. We've heard about them bringing guys up through their minor league system, having all these young prospects, and now fresh off an NLCS trip last year, realizing, all right, it's time for us to take the next step now, and that's adding a piece like this that's ready to get you into and over that World Series hump, hopefully. Now the way you've structured your team, it's the natural progression for them here.
He just sounds just like his dad.
That's right.
It's sort of unsettling. All right, Neil, you earlier this week at 538 did an analysis of where every team stands and where and whether what they should do with the trade deadline. Right. And mm-hmm. and that this is based off of their record, their chances of winning the division, chance of winning the World Series. Did it factor in their farm system at all, or was it just about their state in the league at this moment?
Yeah, you know, it didn't take into account things like farm systems. I should back up a little bit. So it's, the system that we kind of looked at was one that Nate Silver, our esteemed editor-in-chief here at 538, and I came up with last year. We called it the Doyle number.
Doyle. Why Doyle?
So
Neil.
Doyle Alexander was a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers in the 1980s. He was on the Braves, and the Braves traded him to the Tigers in exchange for one of their top pitching prospects. That pitching prospect turned out to be John Smoltz, future Hall of Famer. And so kind of, you know, they got a couple pretty good years out of Doyle Alexander, but it kind of became known as an infamous example of a trade where you give away a really talented young player who becomes a great player down the road in exchange for just a little while spent with a veteran and trying to kind of figure out what is the trade-off involved in that.
Because, I mean, any team, not just in baseball, but especially in baseball where farm systems are so integral to a team's development, this is the question that all of them approach in midsummer is, you know, especially now with the second wild card, do I have a chance of making a run? And more teams do because of the second wild card. And so that's changed the game a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. And so the Doyle number at its core represents basically it's this multiplier saying how many future wins of talent should you give up over the next 6 years, kind of parceled out, spread out over the next 6 years in exchange for 1 year this year. And it kind of recognizes this. It tries to set the equivalency between, you know, you're giving up some measure of wins in the future and getting them in the present, but you want to kind of break even on your World Series championships won.
All right. So the Cubs, for example, had, and this is, I think, before
this
the Doyle,
was right before
the Chapman trade.
They
had a Doyle of 2.01, right, standing with a 59-38 record, Their talent suggested they should finish with 94.6 wins this year.
Well, that means that if they have 95 wins of talent or had before they picked up Chapman, he'll add about one win to their total of talent. You know, if they had to play 162 more games right now with exactly that crew, they would be expected to win about 95 games. Okay. So it doesn't take into account
their current record.
It takes into account your current record to the extent that it measures your odds of getting to the division series. You know, we kind of consider it to be, we're kind of old school in that respect about making the playoffs and getting past the point of that one game playoff. And then also it kind of measures how often from there should you win the World Series based on your talent. And I think one of the most instructive things that we found for the trade deadline when we were doing our Doyle research last year is that there's really no such thing as having too much talent on a team if you are in a position to make a serious push for the World Series. So a team like the Cubs, who are almost certain to make the playoffs, and it's really just a matter of how much they can load up to, you know, win once they are in the playoffs, that you don't hit a degree of diminishing returns. A lot of times people think about the trade deadline as being for teams that are on the bubble of playoff contention, and that can be important. Those are teams that we'll talk about a little later, about teams on the precipice of having to make that decision of buying or selling. But it's also really important for teams at the top of the league, because, you know, baseball is such a random sport that even if you can increase your odds of winning the World Series once you make the playoffs from 15% to 20% or from 20% to 25%, those are enormous gains, and it's actually worth it. The Doyle number of 2 means that the Cubs should be willing to give up twice as many wins, double the wins of future talent spread out over the next 6 seasons, just to get one win this season, meaning that they should go all in.
So let's move on to the middling teams. So it seems obvious what the Cubs and Nationals should do. And so it sounds like, Neil, you were a fan of the Chapman trade, even though they gave up so much.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
And so then we have this middle pack of teams ranging basically from the Rangers to the Marlins, all of whom have a Doyle of 0.8 to 1.0. And again, the Cubs are at 2 at the top of the league. So about half as doily. You should send them doilies.
That's right.
Neil, with their monogram number stitched in.
GR, Texas
so
Rangers.
Let's just, you know, take one of these teams, for example. I'm just looking up and down the list.
Randomly.
I'm going to pick randomly. I'm going to say we should talk about the Mets with a Doyle number of 0.89. The Mets are 52-45 on the year. If they played another 162 games, their talent would suggest that they would win about 88 of them. They only have a 28.5 chance of winning the division, and that's in large part because of the Nationals being so good in that division series odd. So, Neil, the Mets. Let me tell you from where I sit what's going on with the Mets right now.
Okay.
And listeners of Panic City, the premier podcast about Mets fans' emotions, a spinoff pod from Hot Takedown, will know this well. The Mets are mediocre. The Mets are not bad. They're not great. They're probably mediocre to good. They're going to finish above 500 and probably don't have the raw talent to win a World Series this year. However, Neil, you and I have sat on this podcast and you have told me that all you got to do is get to the playoffs, and then baseball playoffs are incredibly random and anything can happen and pitching dominates and yada, yada, la, la. And so I wonder, in my heart of hearts, I don't think the Mets should do anything. If anything, they should sell, because they're not going to win the World Series. And so you might as well get rid of Cologne, dare I say it. You might as well see if you can get anything for Cespedes in the last 3 months, even maybe. But my question, Neil, is that short-sighted me or long-sighted? You know, what sight should a Mets fan or a fan of the Rangers, Orioles, Blue Jays, Cardinals, and Marlins, what scope sight should they be using?
No, I think that's a very kind of long view approach, and according to Doyle, the Mets are like so close to being you know, there's such an edge case by this, but if you have a Doyle number below 1, that typically means that you should sell, because it means that wins in the present are not worth as much to you in terms of World Series probability as wins in the future.
And you don't care as much about a team making the wild card game, because the wild card game is so random?
If we did this based on the wild card game, I think, first of all, it would shift things dramatically down. It would actually kind of devalue teams like the Cubs going out and adding talent, because why why should they? They already have locked up a playoff spot for all intents and purposes, and it would really put a lot of emphasis on teams like the Mets. But as it is, because we're looking at World Series one, it does shift that curve upward, and you don't hit those diminishing returns, and so you end up with these teams in the middle that are kind of right on the precipice. I should also say a Doyle number as it approaches zero means that wins have practically no value to you in the present day, because most likely because you have almost no chance at making the playoffs. So a lot of these teams in the middle are teams that either, you know, they don't have as much talent according to the numbers as their record would indicate. I think the Rangers and the Orioles are teams that are examples of that for sure. Teams that have gotten off to really good records and have high odds of making the divisional round of the playoffs, yet at the same time don't really have a huge amount of talent. There's an argument to be made that you should take advantage of that situation in and of itself and load up on talent until you do have enough talent to kind of match the other teams in the playoffs. But there's another school of thought that should say, you know, you should see how things play out, but don't sell the farm for this current season, and that's what Doyle is trying to kind of measure the trade-off there, and it says that teams like that should be sellers.
So that tells me about buying and holding. Does Doyle tell me anything about selling, which is to say, you know, when should a team hollow itself out and just say this year definitely isn't the year? Is it anybody who has less than a 10% chance of winning the division? Is it about just sort of trying to make sure that you get the most for your assets no matter when you're selling?
The kind of cool but also difficult to conceptualize thing about Doyle is that it's just this exchange rate between present value and future value, but it can change based on how much value is on the table. So what we're looking at is kind of this generic number of if you were to try to go out and get any amount of wins or trade away any amount of wins, this is kind of the rate at which you should kind of be pricing these two things. But for instance, if the Mets were to try to go out and bring in 8 wins, they should be willing to spend as much as 11.7 wins of present of future value in order to get 8 wins today, because that would kind of push them up. It would increase their talent this year, and that would kind of compound. It would make them more likely to make the playoffs, and it also would make them more likely to win once they got to the playoffs, and those are important considerations. But at the same time, your value of future wins in exchange for present wins, if you're selling, also goes up depending on how much you're willing to sell. If the Mets sold 8 wins on the market, then that could be they could ask for 14 wins of future value in exchange for that, and it would come out the same in terms of World Series odds, because these teams have almost like this inflection point, and that's why they're around this 1.0 Doyle mark, is that they're in the middle, and that's a great argument to be made against what you said of doing nothing, which is these teams need to pick a direction to go in and just embrace it.
Does every team need to pick a direction to go in?
No. So teams that are already locked up into the playoffs, like the Cubs, for instance, they should be buying. They're teams that have high Doyle numbers, mm-hmm. and you know, selling wouldn't make much sense for them. But then at the other end of the spectrum, a team like the Atlanta Braves should not be buying at all. Wins
have
no value to them.
Well, of course, but should they still be selling? That's the question.
Well, they should absolutely. Yeah, exactly. I mean,
so this is the conversation we've had about the Sixers. When do you stop selling?
Well, in baseball, you know, the replacement level team, according to the metrics, would win something like 45-50 games in a season. So it wouldn't even be a case of the Sixers where it's like, oh, are they ever actually going
to win? No, but this is about
whether
you should keep trading for – like, should there be any team in the MLB that is holding? That's the question.
Well, so some teams kind of have no preference between the two, and they don't have that U-shaped curve. It's only the teams in the middle that have that, and those are the –
So it's okay for the Braves and the Brewers to hold?
No, I mean they should be selling
anyone who's
assets.
Good, right? Luke Roy should
anyone
be leaving the
good.
Brewers, for example.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so every
because
team
have no value.
So every team
them.
Should be buying or selling at the trade deadline.
Right,
that's what I'm trying to get to.
Okay, you know, it does depend on the market, also, we should say. And so, you know, it's not like you can go to the counter, the Major League Baseball, you know, food counter, and say, hey, okay, I'm going to buy 8
right.
wins worth of food
right,
right here, and give
They're
me
not
my
vouchers.
Yeah, exactly. So. You know, it does depend on kind of feeling out what else is out there.
But for example, in the Mets example, Sandy Alderson, the GM, has said no major deals are expected at the trade deadline. And your point, Neil, is that every team should be trying to pursue deals at the minimum. One Whether or not they paths. Work or not is obviously up to the market, but you got to buy, you got to sell. Holding is a short-sighted, is actually the real short-sighted move in baseball.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's what Doyle says. Okay. Particularly about teams exactly like the Mets, which are in that group that you mentioned of teams on the precipice, that just, you know, one little decision in either direction could
change a franchise,
change the
forever.
Franchise course of history, for sure.
Ooh, I feel like I really extracted one of the grander statements that I've ever extracted from you on the show. Now.
But it is true.
Okay. Okay, now on to the WNBA, where one of those narratives that Kate Fagan is always talking to us about, that, you know, she wishes that the media would find the remarkable things that are happening inside of women's sports and talk about them rather than just let them go by. We are seeing one of them happen right now with Nemkati Ogwumike, an LA Sparks forward who has just come onto the scene. I mean, not that she was an unheralded player. She was picked first in the WNBA draft a few years ago out of Stanford. And had a good season, named the All-WNBA defensive team, was sort of a role player alongside Candace Parker for the Sparks. And yet this season, Neil, you've compiled her incredible achievements. Talk to us about what's going on with Ogwumike.
Yeah, right now she is putting up numbers that are just eye-popping right at the moment. And we're about 70% of the way done with the WNBA season. But right now she has a 33.2 player efficiency rating.
Contextualize that for us.
That is the third highest of all time in a single season.
Okay.
And she has 0.479 win shares per 48 minutes, which is kind of a wonky stat.
Oh, straight to the advanced stats, Neil. You know, I was going to tell you that she shot 100% from the field in June.
Well, that was one game.
I know. I was going to tell you that she leads the WNBA in rebounding, 14 rebounds
a game,
20
points
per game.
She is doing so many amazing things that we can get to it. But if you look at those two stats and kind of combine them into one metric that kind of sums up a player's advanced stats contribution, this is the second greatest season in the history of the WNBA on a per-minute basis, second only to Lauren Jackson in 2006. And what's interesting is, like you said at the top of the segment, she wasn't a bad player. She was actually a pretty good player going into the season, but had never done anything like this. This is the kind of thing that we've seen. Elena Deladon last year, for instance, she's having a better year than Deladon did, and that was we talked about her as having arguably the best season in WNBA history at the time. And, you know, there are certain players that have seasons like that that you sort of expect it. Cynthia Cooper was someone that we also have mentioned being one of the great early players, probably the great early player of the WNBA. And you just didn't think Neko Ogwumike would be in that conversation. And all of a sudden, especially she's been in the league for 5 years now. And so for her to come out and have this kind of a season is truly remarkable. We crunched some numbers. We did a little bit of a simple projection of WNBA player seasons just based on the track record of the player and tried to come up with, you know, what we would think based on a player's past history they would do. And we found that the odds of someone like Ogwumike with her track record putting up this particular season were about 1 in 2,000. And this is a bigger single-season improvement than any player, for instance, on the men's side in the NBA has ever had using the same metric. And so it's just really one of the most unlikely kind of stories of a player taking the leap. We talk about the leap a lot. And oftentimes...
This is a rope swing.
I know. Oftentimes in the NBA, the players that end up being the best player in the NBA are players that kind of from very early in their career, we see that potential within
them. Well, she was a
number one overall draft pick. But I mean, based on her track record since then, and again, that's four seasons of you know, somewhere like 1,000 minutes apiece or more, that... You know, you got the sense of what kind of a player she was, and very rarely in the sport of basketball particularly do you see a player kind of have one of these all-time great seasons just from out of the clear blue sky.
So
in baseball, it happens more, I think, because there's so much more variance. You'll see a player who otherwise in their career doesn't have, you know, great MVP or all-time great season have just one year where everything comes together.
Sorry, Daniel Murphy's stuck in my throat.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a great example. And we don't really bat that much of an eye when we see someone like Daniel Murphy. And I think that's kind of an interesting comparison, because it's another case of somebody who is pretty good suddenly having a season that should belong to someone like Barry Bonds.
So what has changed with Ogumike's play? You know, what aspects of her game have improved? And, you know, how do we see that manifest on the stat sheet?
Well, it's really been an across-the-board improvement. I think the biggest thing that jumps out is the shooting. Right now, she has the highest true shooting percentage of any player in WNBA history also, and this was kind of a really mind-boggling stat. So her true shooting percentage this year is
remind us what true shooting is?
So true shooting is just a measure of shooting efficiency. It's basically points per shot, which includes free throw attempts, but then it's kind of scaled to look like a field goal percentage. And so her true shooting is 76.9 this year. That's the best in history. And in fact, the second best single season mark in history is 70. So the difference between Ogumike at number one and Candace Dupree, who had number two in 2010, that 70%, is the same as the difference between number two Dupree and number 27 on the all-time single season true shooting list. So that's something where she's shooting 71% on twos and 69% on threes. That's probably going to go down a little bit as we approach the end of the season, and especially as defenses start to key on her. But I thought it was interesting that her efficiency in that regard has gone through the roof, but it's also come with an improvement in usage rate and assist rate, things that we kind of take as being measures of workload and offensive responsibility. And we've often talked about this kind of inverse relationship between the more responsibility that you have to take on for a team, the less efficient that you're able to be. But in this case, she has actually taken on more responsibility and her efficiency has skyrocketed.
It does seem like it's not sustainable, right? Like, I mean,
the shooting probably
it may be that she's become much better in the offseason, but it does also seem as though something, I mean, there's a regression that has to come. That this just can't be who any player would be in any given year.
I think that's true, but then there's also, you look at the rebound rate, for instance, is also way up, and that's something that actually kind of belongs to the player and is less prone to things like randomness. And her, you know, defensive win shares are also up. So she's had this across-the-board increase that goes beyond something that just, you know, if it was just shooting, we could say, oh, you know, she is just making some lucky shots and that hot streak will kind of cool down as the sample size increases. But it's not just that, it's other areas of the game too. And I think it also speaks to the way in which she's being used on the Sparks. And it's not a coincidence that the Sparks, they're a below 500 team last year, and they've always been kind of one of the more disappointing teams given the fact that they have Candace Parker, who's one of the best players in WNBA history. They really have not been able to kind of scratch the surface consistently of making a deep playoff push or put together one of these great team seasons with Parker. But they have made this dramatic improvement. They're 21-3 right now at the Olympic break, and that's a 71-72 win pace if you played 82 games, to kind of compare it to the Golden State Warriors, who won 73 games. And they've been just an offensive machine, and some of that has to do with the shooting of Ogumike, but it also has to do with the fact that they're playing a different style of basketball. They're passing the ball more. They have the highest assist rate of any team in the WNBA right now, and they've gotten rid of some of the more kind of staid, stagnant elements of half-court offense, like pick and rolls and post-ups and isolations, and they're doing a lot more off-ball cutting, and Ogumike's success in that is sort of stemming this, you know, it's created this trend. And also they're playing a lot more in transition, and they're the most efficient offense now in the history of the WNBA per 100 possessions. So it's working.
So let's talk about the WNBA as a league as a whole. It is sort of bleak out there after the top four teams. I know, Neil, that you've been looking into this a bit, but I just want to sort of set the scene, if you will. In the Eastern Conference, the New York Liberty are in the lead at 18-8. And then the Dream are 13 and 12, and then everyone else is 500 or below. In the Western Conference, you have two teams at the top, Sparks and the Lynx, way out ahead, 21 and 3 and 21 and 4, neck and neck for first. And then,
they're all big drop off.
The next closest team is 10 and 14. That's the Mercury. So, Neil, what is happening to the NBA that there are four teams above 500 and then, what is that, eight teams below or at or below?
Yeah, you know, we've seen this before in distinct periods of the WNBA's history, especially early. There were, you know, big imbalances. But a lot of those had to do with teams also at the bottom being bad in addition to teams at the top. Right now, there are some below 500 teams, but there are comparatively fewer just truly awful teams than there were in other periods of sort of, you know, wide variance between the best and the worst teams in the league. I think this particular case is marked by, and maybe this is an encouraging thing from the standpoint of building rivalries and having, you know, great teams go against each other. It's been driven more at the top of the standings by, like you mentioned, especially these two teams that each have fewer than five losses apiece. And then on the other side, the Liberty really would be one of the best teams in the league in most other seasons, but now they're kind of a distant third behind the Sparks and the Lynx, who are kind of seem destined to fight it out on the road to the championship.
Right, although the Liberty will get one of them most likely in the finals. All right, Neil, thanks for bringing us Tales from the WNBA.
Of course.
Okay, now to bring the show home, what we do every week, the significant digit, a telling number from the world of sports. Someone who has brought us that significant digit this week is not Neil Payne. It's Carl Bialik. Hello, Carl.
Hello, Chad.
538's Carl Bialik, of course, and also Hot Takedown Senior Executive Global Administrator of Tennis Coverage. Carl.
If you had lost the coverage, I really would have been excited.
You just want to be of tennis?
Someone needs to.
Carl, something sad happened in tennis today. Tell us about it.
Well, Roger Federer, just before the Olympics and a month before the U.S. Open starts, announced he is done for the season. Mm. He's done for the year. He says he'll be back next year. He's got to rehab his knee.
And this is after an earlier knee surgery that he had, this year or last year?
He had an accident supposedly taking care of his kids in the bath after the Australian Open.
I like supposedly there, that you're calling into doubt.
Well, Jeff Kent,
the conspiracy theorist in Carl.
Only because every other human being who plays tennis has knee problems from tennis, but Federer, who's been pretty much injury-free in his career, has an injury right after a grueling match against Djokovic.
Should have never had kids.
In the bathroom.
All right, so what's the significant digit on Fed's knee?
The digit is 3. And that is the men who have won at least 3 Grand Slam titles in the Open era, which is when the 4 majors went pro in 1968, started paying money. Those men have won a combined total of 3 major titles after turning 35. And Federer will be 35 next year.
So the category that Federer belongs to, injury or no, there have only been 3 men or 3 majors that have been won.
One man did it, and it was 3 times.
Wow.
Ken Rosewall.
So only one other person in open era tennis history.
Man.
One other man, excuse me, in open era tennis history has been able to accomplish what Federer will hope to accomplish after he comes back.
Yeah.
From a knee injury. And when was the last major that Federer won?
2012 Wimbledon.
So it's already been a while.
Yeah. So this stat was relevant if we were looking ahead to next year or even to the U.S. Open before this announcement, because he was going to be 35 by the time the U.S. Open starts. So now we're talking about coming back from an injury at an age when almost no one has even competed for majors.
I was talking to Neil about this before the show. What I get that he's a competitor and he's been born to compete and he wants to compete at a high level. At some point, I don't know. The question I think is, is it worth doing the thing that you love not as well as you once were able to do it? Or do you stop loving it as much when you can't win a major?
Well, this is what the man himself said today. This experience has made me realize how lucky I've been throughout my career. The love I have for tennis, the competition, the tournaments, and of course you, the fans, remains intact. So I think a lot of players have talked about, you know, you're away from the sport. It just makes you miss it all the more.
That's true. If I went on a year-long break from journalism... Maybe I'd come raring back even if I knew that I could not be nearly as good as my, you know, somewhat mediocre status that I already
We did. Should A-B test this, Jeff.
Yeah, it's good. All right, Carl Bialik, thanks for bringing us our sig dig.
Thanks for having me.
That will do it for this week's show. Neil.
Hey,
thanks. Chad. Thanks for chatting.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks for talking to me about Doyles. Thanks for knitting me a doily while
Always,
we talked.
Always, you know, it was monogrammed also, so there's two monogrammed ones, one for the Texas Rangers and one for you, Chad.
What are my initials, Neil?
CM.
CTEM. That's for another pod.
Wow.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast knit master is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. Our sports intern this summer at 538 is Cedric Crawford. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcast app or on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to subscribe to 538's other podcasts, the Election Podcast, and What's the Point, our data and culture podcast. While you're there, be sure to review and rate the show, all of the shows, while you're there, of course, as well. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.